Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we talk to a Decatur ice carver who's been invited to the 2006 Winter Olympics in Torino, Italy. We profile some of the musicians who joined Arlo Guthrie on his recent ride on the City New Orleans, a benefit to help victims of Hurricane Katrina, and we chat with the author of Post Secret, Extraordinary Confessions from Ordinary Lives. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Folk singer Arlo Guthrie performed in Urbana last month to raise money for New Orleans musicians who lost instruments, equipment, and performing venues to Hurricane Katrina. The audience at the Canopy Club heard Arlo sing his best-known songs, including Alice's Restaurant and City of New Orleans, and they heard music from Guthrie's family, both his biological family and his extended musical family. Jim Meadows features some of those performers.
Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son.
Arlo Guthrie performed his hit City of New Orleans for the news media, seeing him off in Chicago on his benefit tour because he's a celebrity. But he says he wasn't supposed to be one. Arlo says neither the song, written by the late Steve Goodman, or his recording of it was meant to be a hit.
First of all, in those days, radios wouldn't play anything that was over 2.5 minutes. And City of New Orleans is a lot longer than that. I mean, if it was 2:31, they wouldn't play it on popular music, you know, radio stations. And it was very different in its sound. It was very simple. It was a plaintive kind of song, a song about the disappearing way of life in America. No one ever looked for those kinds of songs to be popular.
Arlo says City of New Orleans comes from a period in the 1960s and 70s when singer-songwriters like Goodman and himself were able to make a dent in pop music culture. But he says he's used to mostly working under the radar of the music industry. Most of the musicians who joined Arlo for the tour are still under the radar of commercial success, like it or not. They included Arlo's son Abe and his rock band Xavier, and daughter Sarah Lee Guthrie and her husband and musical partner, Johnny Irian.
Yeah, I've performed in New Orleans before, actually at Tipitina's where we're going to play. I'm real excited to get back down. And just like Sarah Lee was saying, you know, we're all giving. We're all playing for free. And hopefully, you know, the tour will help bring awareness that New Orleans still needs help. You know, Arlo felt like, what can we do as musicians? And we just followed right in with the way he was thinking. It was a great idea.
We've been doing a song called Exploration. That's actually the title track to our last record. And, you know, it's got some really nice lines in there that I think kind of sum up what we're doing.
As I look up at the stars, exploration on Mars, there's a lot of left here to do. People asking us for change, people sleeping in the streets, politicians still don't have a clue. Looking out my door at the downtrodden for sure, but they ain't in their neck of the woods.
While members of the Guthrie family have performed in New Orleans only rarely or not at all prior to the tour, singer and songwriter Jack Nielsen is a New Orleans resident who left town as part of the mandatory evacuation but is now back in the city.
I'm a lucky evacuee, as I keep saying. I feel like a really fortunate evacuee that, I mean, the stories around me, there's thousands and thousands of stories around me that so much more severe, and it's just all relative. You know, I have friends in different parts of the city. It really depended on where you lived. Some places that normally flood with heavy rains didn't necessarily flood from Katrina this time. And some that never get it just really got flooded.
Nielsen, who was the opening act at the Guthrie concert in Urbana, handed me a copy of his 2003 CD, Here I Go Again, and pointed out track one.
Hello, My Old Friend is the first cut that, you know, I wouldn't have gotten this CD made unless it was for an old friend that believed in me enough to say, you need to cut a CD. You never did this your whole life. Why didn't you ever cut a CD?
Hello, my old friend. It's good to see you again. I missed your point of view. Come on over my house tonight. Maybe we'll knock down a few till we get it right. Passes so quickly, like it was all yesterday. But I know you'd look the same. Such a wonder, but it ain't no crying shame, 'cause we made the best go far.
Also performing with Arlo Guthrie in Urbana were the Byrne sisters, Jeannie, Annie, and Marie. Their music features close vocal harmonies that Annie Byrne says come to them naturally.
Performing with my sisters, we go into a natural, like, unspoken form. Like, we can just, like, last night we sang backups to songs we'd never heard before. So, we'd heard them once, and then we go into a form of that we're used to, which is, like, high, middle, and low, and just sing. And it's powerful to sing with your family.
Come, come, whoever you are, this caravan has no despair. Even though you have broken your vows perhaps 10,000 times, still come again, come.
That Burns Sisters performance is on a CD on the Philo label that the sisters handed me entitled Tradition. It's mostly a collection of Christmas songs, but that particular cut features words by the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, whose death is commemorated just a few days before Christmas on December 17th. Another musician I spoke with on the Arlo Guthrie tour took the role of a sideman in the Urbana concert, but Gordon Titcomb could be heard singing one of his songs a few nights earlier on the train carrying the musicians from Chicago to Kankakee.
My granddad was a railroad man. He drove the trains around. My daddy, he sold tickets till they closed the station down. Now the tracks that shone like silver have turned to rusty brown. 30 years ago, the last train rolled through town.
The Last Train is the title cut of the CD Gordon Titcomb released in 2005, his first solo effort after many years as a studio musician and sideman.
It's sort of a mournful look, although it's not a mournful song, at the demise of the railroads. If you notice on the cover, there's sort of a picture of a derelict train station, and I'm standing with my guitar and banjo and luggage looking at my watch, and it's, you know, the intention of this photograph is to show the viewer that the train probably is not coming, and by the looks of the tracks and the station itself, the train hasn't been through there in an awfully long time.
I'm riding on the city of New Orleans, thinking about the Wabash Cannonball and its midnight fire. That lonesome freight train whistle call.
Arlo Guthrie plays guitar on this and two other songs on Gordon Titcomb's CD, which is sold through Arlo's own music company, Rising Sun. Arlo formed Rising Sun in the 1980s and hasn't recorded for a major label since. He says growing up, the son of the famous but uncommercial folk singer Woody Guthrie has shaped his own idea of musical success.
It was never meant to be popular music. It was always, I think, meant to be in the tradition of the kind of people who were telling their life story or telling the stories of other people. Writers who sort of capture a time and a place and an essence of where we are and who we are and where we're going and what we're doing, they become part of the soundtrack of people's lives.
Arlo Guthrie's City of New Orleans tour lasted for 8 performances over 2 weeks from Chicago to New Orleans. Later in January, Arlo resumes his regular touring, marking the 40th anniversary of the events chronicled in Alice's Restaurant. But he's still raising money to help New Orleans musicians. You can find out more at his website at arlo.net. I'm Jim Meadows.
All the towns and people seem to fade into a bad dream, and the steel rails still ain't heard the news. The conductor sings his songs again, the passengers will please refrain. This train's got the disappearing railroad news. And good night, America.
Links to websites with more information on Arlo Guthrie and the other artists on the City of New Orleans can be found on the Sidetrack page of the WILL website. Go to will.uiuc.edu. This is Sidetrack. The focus in Torino, Italy this February will be on speed skating, the luge, and other contests we've come to know as part of the Olympic Winter Games. But there's another group that has had a role in the Winter Games since 1998. 40 ice carvers from 28 nations will participate in the Olympic Ice Sculpting Competition as part of the Cultural Olympiad at the 2006 Games. The U.S. competitors will include Decatur area native Eric Kendall. Jeff Bossert spoke with Kendall about how he developed his skills in ice carving.
What attracted you to this art form? Why ice carving?
I was a chef for 10 years and went to culinary school, and being involved in the kitchen, I got to watch one of the first chefs that I worked for. I watched him carve for about 6 months, and then we went to a scholarship brunch in Springfield and to raise money for kids to go to culinary school, and they were going to do an ice carving demonstration or ice carving on the buffet, and so they did two of them, and I did one side by side with another sculptor, and ever since then I bought a chainsaw and kept going from there.
Now, is this a full-time gig for you?
Yeah, now it's turned into a full-time job. I have a studio where I carve, I make my own ice, and have a shop where I can carve.
Where do you go to various shows to demonstrate your craft? I mean, I guess that takes up the majority of your time?
Sure. The competition season usually runs from the first part of January through the end of March. And basically through my National Ice Carving Association that I'm a member of, they publish a flyer every month, and it has a list of competitions all around the world, from China, Japan. The World Championships are held in Fairbanks, Alaska, and Canada, and all across the United States.
So where have you been?
I've been to, the past 2 years, I went to the World Championships in Fairbanks, Alaska. I've been to Ottawa, Canada. I've been to probably eight or nine different states, and all over the country, it seems like.
So what are some of the things that you've carved that have gotten you notoriety at some of these competitions?
In Ottawa, I carved a 12-foot-tall phoenix. And in Alaska, I carved a 15-foot-tall Pegasus out of an 8,000-pound block. It took 3 days to carve. I also worked on a team event up there that you carve 55,000 pounds of ice. And we ended up carving a crystal fairy jumping through an archway that was 32 feet tall with a keystone and everything. And I've also carved, last year, my father and I carved a 15-foot-wide hand glider.
And what do you plan to carve for the Olympics?
For the Olympics, I'm qualified in the abstract category, and my theme the Italian panel has decided that they want people to carve to certain themes, and my theme is sports and harmony. And so I'm going to be carving two figure skaters, a male and female figure skater, executing a lift.
How many hours does it take to do something like that?
We have 8 blocks of ice, which is approximately 2,400 pounds, and the time of the competition is 18 hours broken up over 2 days.
What are you most proud of? I mean, what stands out by your standards, what you've done?
I don't really have one particular sculpture that's my favorite. I enjoy carving wildlife, and lately it seems like I've been scoring well and placing well with things in abstract form. Seems like that's something kind of new and different, something that's catching the judges' eyes. Every piece is my favorite whenever I get done with it. Just hope I get a good picture of it.
What's out there yet for you to carve? I mean, what are some challenges that you'd like to pursue?
Well, I'd like to go back to Ottawa again. I'll definitely go back to Fairbanks, Alaska, to the World Championship. Right now, I'm just looking forward to carving with different carvers and teaming up and learning from people. And it's a constant learning experience, you know, just seeing the tools and how they're used and how I can execute that into something that I want to accomplish.
Is this something that maybe is getting a little underappreciated?
I don't know exactly how long it's been around, but I think, you know, now it's getting to be where there's, you know, if someone's looking for an ice carving, there's someone within, you know, I would say 3 hours of their town that can do one for them. You know, through the National Ice Carving Association, they can get on the website and look up and see which carver is in their area.
So are you called upon, too, for smaller jobs, like maybe an ice sculpture for some sort of social gathering or wedding?
Absolutely. That's you know, 80 or 90% of my business is carvings for weddings, parties, corporate functions. I do table centerpieces for the tables instead of flowers or in combination with flowers. Any kind of event, party, things like that.
Again, how long have you been carving?
I've been carving for 12 years.
Anything else you want to add on career aspirations and what you hope to achieve with the visit to Italy?
Well, obviously, I'd like to win a gold medal, but first and foremost, I'm just going to experience it and see some of Italy and experience the camaraderie from 40 carvers total throughout the world.
Do we know how many countries will be competing in this?
I'm not for sure on the total number of countries. There's going to be a total of 7 carvers from the United States going, and I don't know how many other countries are going to be there. I know there'll be people there from representing Japan and China and, you know, probably Norway and France is going to be there, and Italy will have carvers there, and any country that has good ice carvers, they're going to be there more than likely.
Now, with all these competitions, do you know the other carvers from the U.S.?
Sure, yeah. I work with them. I work with their companies sometimes. It's a pretty good brotherhood of networking. You know, if someone gets a lot of orders and they need help and they're not able to complete all their carvings by the, you know, let's say Christmas, they have 40 carvings going out. Sometimes they'll call me or, you know, have me come in and do some carvings for them to help meet their quota. It's a whole brotherhood of sharing knowledge and tools and experiences. And like, if I have a question about anything, I can just call up, you know, several people and see what they think or how they execute something or how they use something.
So it's a friendly competition with one another.
Oh, exactly. I mean, we're all friends when it's said and done. Sometimes, you know, you may not always agree with the judging because it is an art form and it is subjective to other people's perspective of what you've accomplished or what you've set out to accomplish. The main thing is just going into a competition with the idea that, you know, you want to complete your sculpture and complete it and carve it to the best of your ability and be satisfied with the work that you've put forward. And the judges will view it however they want, but the picture that you take, you know, stays in your portfolio forever.
Jeff Bossert spoke with ice carver Eric Kendall. The Argenta, Illinois native will take his skills to Italy in February as part of the cultural portion of the 2006 Winter Olympiad. For more information on the art of ice carving, visit the National Ice Carving Association's website at nica.org. A full schedule of cultural Olympic events can be found online at torino2006.org. You're listening to Sidetrack. Have you ever taken a close look at older aprons? Jiffy Johnson reports on one woman who does just that.
Esther Duncan of Vetersburg, Indiana has, and she explained to me at the Farm Progress Show why farming families used aprons in the past.
Women and men wore aprons always as a protective garment, and they protect the clothes from underneath. Aprons have been with us for many, many years. So the apron was actually first worn by a man, that where I start in history. And then I bring it forward to the 1960s and the women's movement when she burned her bra, I say. She burned her apron as well.
So the apron disappeared, but you're recreating these aprons?
I'm more interested in the person wearing the apron, the farm woman, than I am the apron itself, really. The apron tells me a lot about that person. The apron that's tattered and torn, those are the wear patterns that I look for that tell me about the character. All of the other different styles, I take yesteryear's styles and adapt today's fabrics to it.
What to you is an ideal apron, particularly for the traditional house use?
First of all, I would want a full apron, what is considered a full apron that falls from the shoulders. That apron would be maybe attached in back with crisscross straps. This apron sort of evolves or would evolve from the old pinna apron that came to us around the 12th century.
Now, is that the pinafore, so-called?
No, you're getting ahead. The pinna apron was a bodice attached to a skirt. They always wore the skirt apron. But the pinna apron, the pinna was a bodice attached with pins on the bodice that held it up. The lady or whoever invented that thought that perhaps she needed some protection on her clothing up a little bit further than the waist. And then somebody added straps later on around, it was probably in the 1760s, somewhere in the middle 1700s, and that's your pinafore. And the pinafore, at the time the straps were added, became a child's garment. But the kind of apron I would like would fall from the shoulders to the about 4 inches above the hemline. They generally tied in back.
And they were primarily, I presume, made out of washable fabric because they would collect a lot of debris as you were making bread, pies, feeding children, whatever.
Well, obviously, all of the fabrics were woven in cotton. The linen apron sort of went out of favor when cotton came to the Western Europe from India, and the cotton muslin sort of overshadowed the linen. Up until that time, linen was the fabric of choice. The only thing about them, if they weren't yarn dyed, they were printed, and some of those colors that they printed them in weren't exactly color fast. We didn't get color fastness until the late 30s, early 40s. So, and then of course we always had the feed sack apron, and the feed sacks clothed 100 pounds of livestock feed, poultry feed of some kind, and those sacks, we didn't think they were the best fabric in the world, but today, as I look back and use some of the original feed sack fabrics, they're better than any I've ever used.
Well, and the fabric was, in a sense, free because you'd already paid for the feed.
Absolutely, and that all came about at a time when the woman needed her fabric the most. She was struggling in the Depression. She maybe didn't have fabric.
You have in front of me here a basket full of all sorts of aprons. Tell me a little bit about a few of them.
I'm starting out with a beautiful linen checked 1830s. I've dated it back to the 1830s. It has wear patterns, it has patches. It has been originally sewn by hand, and it's what we call oversewn. So it's been worn by the woman for maybe almost 100 years. She's found use out of this. It's a very wonderful old apron. It's just simply one of my favorites. I will keep it. I know one of these days it will disintegrate, but I do reproduce this apron. It has a lot of interest from the living history people wanting to reproduce periods of time and the clothes women wore, which I do.
Now, that had a patch, actually. I mean, there's places where they've had to replace part of the fabric. Did I see that?
It isn't like it is today. You couldn't go to the store and buy whatever you needed to do what, and if the occasion arose, you didn't make a new apron. And for every day, which this probably started out as a better apron, and she just wore it and wore it and wore it. I can see a pioneer lady wearing this. And when it wore out, you're exactly right. You see patches, and these patches are sewn by hand. They become a part of the fabric. You hardly notice them. Several things identify this as far as the period. The hooks and eyes that you see sewn on here have been added later. She might have felt she needed that. She didn't go out and make a new one and say, this one goes to the rag bag. She made it over, and she made it according to the era she was living in. Styles and clothing change about every 2 years. And, of course, aprons followed the style of the dress. This is a gathered garment and gathered at the yoke. So it's very, she can move in it, a very typical apron of the period.
Now, that one actually hangs basically down from the shoulders, right? There's not a bodice, there's not a waist, per se, in this particular apron.
That's a very popular style. Also, it hangs to the skirt, and the skirt of that period, which helps me in fabric dating, was full. So you see these gussets sewn in the bottom of the skirt. About 10 inches up, there'll be this gusset. Well, she had long skirts, that tells me the period. And she also didn't have the hoop under that skirt, which also tells me under the skirt she had petticoats. And those petticoats had on them flounces that gave the skirt a little swing and movement. Very attractive style. And the apron followed that.
What you're telling me is aprons are often sort of mirrors of the clothing. They're sort of a second reflection of what the person was wearing.
Absolutely. You're exactly right on. Because the apron followed the style of the dress. I can look at an apron and fabric date. I'm looking here at what was called the hostess apron that came in after World War II, maybe in the early 40s.
Now, this is compared to that one, this is like night and day. That one is very workaday. This one is very fancy with little pointed bottom edges that have been carefully trimmed. I don't think it has a stain on it. It looks as though it was only worn on the very best of days.
Absolutely. This is a hostess apron. Women made hostess aprons as they had an apron for every occasion. It was part of that overemphasis of domesticity. We wanted ruffles. We wanted wide ties. We wanted not necessarily to show our needlework skills, but we just wanted to add detail after detail. The sky is the limit on these aprons. We get into the ginghams where they did cross stitch and a stitch called chicken scratch. That's kind of puts it on the farm, but the farm women wore these just as much as anyone else. They took their egg money and they went to pennies and they bought fabric. And this apron I have in front of me here is what I call my Depression era apron, and it's a makeover. This has been another garment, a man's shirt perhaps. She's added a long hem, and on the top of that she might have added rickrack. Or it could have been a lady's dress that she's redoing, and the rickrack was already on that. The fact that it's sewn up like this tells me maybe that, and the wide hem, that the rickrack was already in place, sewn on by hand. It's wide rickrack. Rickrack came out in 1921, but got to the rural areas in about 1923. If there's rickrack on it, I have to look first to see, is it oversewn? Did they reproduce that apron and bring it up to date and put rickrack on an old apron? They could do that. But this one tells me, this old apron, Depression-era apron, tells me that it's a makeover. The ties are actually the shirt sleeves. Mm-hmm. And the end of the tie decoration is the cuffs. Mm-hmm. And so this is very definitely very identifiable as an apron of the Depression era, where she had a little of this and a little of that. And it was make do or do without.
It's also got some signs of machine stitching, which the very early one did not, so I'm assuming that that can help you date as well.
Absolutely. The sewing machine really didn't get to the rural areas until maybe the 1845 to 1850. I think Singer came in about 1850 with a manufactured machine that they sold door to door. This has been first maybe sewn by hand, but I'm thinking it's just the opposite here. Maybe the woman who made it over didn't have a machine. And so she's hemmed it up by hand. Of course, hemming in those days was done by hand. Today, most of our hemming is done by machine.
How many aprons have you collected?
Well, I've collected the aprons that I make, that I reproduce. What I actually do is not try to get a large collection. Women bring me aprons. Women send me aprons. People send me aprons in the mail. It's all word of mouth, and people are just good. Farm women will send me, this was my mother's apron. I'll say, can I reproduce it? I like it. They are most generous in that respect. So I've made hundreds of aprons. I'm probably up near 400 or 500 aprons. But I use today's fabrics on yesteryear styles. I'm in the market constantly for old rickrack, cotton rickrack. You cannot use today's rickrack on 100% cotton fabrics because of the iron setting. And you do iron these. I do make my own patterns. I do not use the retro patterns from today's pattern catalogs and books.
Esther Duncan showed me these aprons at the Farm Progress Show in Decatur. I'm Jiffy Johnson.
Still to come on the program, a man who collects secrets and the 100 best first lines from novels. Stay tuned. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Abraham Lincoln and freedom of speech are the focus of a new book co-written by a Quad Cities man. Neil Dahlstrom from Moline, along with Jeffrey Mamber, have just published Lincoln's Wrath, Fierce Mobs, Brilliant Scoundrels, and A President's Mission to Destroy the Press. Herb Trix reports.
The book is about John Hodgson, who was the editor of a newspaper called the Jeffersonian in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Dahlstrom says Hodgson wanted to preserve the Union, but thought the best way to do that was to oppose Abraham Lincoln before and after the election of 1860.
It's the story of an anti-Lincoln newspaper editor whose office is mobbed and then seized by the United States government shortly after the outbreak of the Civil War. But this editor does something that no other editor does, and he decides to sue the United States government to regain his property. Lincoln was fairly unpopular. He definitely did not win the popular vote. He got well under 50% of the popular vote and wasn't even on the ballot in many southern states. So he was an unpopular president coming in. And that's why the war erupted as soon as he took office. But Hodgson had he was good at using scare tactics in his newspaper, and he was just a vile racist in the worst way. He was the type of guy that if you saw him on the street, you'd probably cross over to the other side so you didn't have to walk by him. But there were people who were out to get him as well. And this went back even before the war, but the war provided an opportunity for those people to destroy him.
After his paper was closed by a mob and his press seized by federal officials, Hodgson sued to get it back, taking his case all the way to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. In fact, it reached the court just as Robert E. Lee and the Confederate Army invaded Pennsylvania in the summer of 1863.
How this case came to be was the passage of the Confiscation Act in Congress, and that was passed in August of 1861, just a few weeks before the paper was seized. And the Confiscation Act, in essence, said that any property used to support the Confederacy could be seized by the United States government. And this is a bill that Lincoln wasn't really sure about. He thought it was kind of premature, but he signed it anyway. And this act allowed local officials, district attorneys, and marshal's deputies to start seizing papers in the name of the president.
Dahlstrom says there are no direct links between Abraham Lincoln and the seizure of Hodgson's newspaper in 1861, but Lincoln did order the seizure of other papers that opposed him.
Of course, when we started 10 years ago, when Jeff started 10 years ago and I started 6 years ago, of course, we weren't in Iraq. Bush wasn't even elected yet, and it's been really amazing to watch the parallels of this story in Lincoln's wrath and things that are going on in Iraq. The Confiscation Act, in many ways, parallels the Patriot Act and what they were trying to do. They were trying to root out possible treason on the home front. They were trying to root out terrorists, and that word was used a few times in the Civil War. Of course, Lincoln had unique circumstances because it was Americans on both sides. But the parallels of really wartime in any age is something that really continues to strike me. And, of course, discussions of the First Amendment, what rights do publishers and editors have during wartime? Is it something where they need to always support the administration in times of war? Do they have the right to speak out against the war?
The book is called Lincoln's Wrath, Fierce Mobs, Brilliant Scoundrels, and a President's Mission to Destroy the Press, and is published by Sourcebooks in Naperville. Dahlstrom is a research archivist for Deer & Company and published his first book last spring, The John Deere Story. I'm Herb Trix.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. We all have secrets. Some are small, some large. Some humorous, and some heartbreaking. About 2 years ago, Frank Warren thought of a way for people to share their secrets. He invited them to write their secrets down on a postcard and mail them to him. A collection of these postcards are in a new book called Post Secret, Extraordinary Confessions from Ordinary Lives. It's published by Regan Books, an imprint of HarperCollins. I talked to Warren recently and asked him to explain the Post Secret project and how it got started.
In November of 2004, I printed up 3,000 self-addressed postcards inviting people to share a secret with me, something that was true and something that they'd never told anyone else before. And I handed these out at bus stops. I stuck them between the pages of library books. And slowly people found the postcards, wrote down their secret, and mailed it to me. And at first they came in kind of slow. I'd receive one or two a week in my mailbox, but now I'm getting hundreds every week.
It's amazing to see how detailed some of these postcards are, because one of the things is you wanted people to include some artwork with the secret to sort of explain it a little more in a visual way. And it's very obvious that people spent a lot of time dealing with their secrets.
I think secrets are very important to people, and I think that's reflected in the postcards I receive. And as you mentioned, the great detail and artistic value a lot of them have. That was one of the big surprises. And one of the joys, frankly, is almost discovering that, like all of us have a story inside of us, I think all of us have an artist inside of us.
Now, some of the secrets, they're funny, they're goofy, there was a Starbucks one, if a customer's rude to me, I give them decaf, stuff like that. But the majority of them are profoundly sad.
A lot of them are sad, and I think the reason they are is because the good things we don't keep private. If we have something that happens to us that makes us look good or we're proud of, we share that with our friends. That ends up in a song or on a resume, but it's the things that cause us shame or embarrassment or humiliation that we tend to hold tightly inside and think that people won't understand if we share it with them. Although I must add, too, that there are a lot of secrets that are hopeful or funny or sexual or confusing. What I've really tried to do is share secrets that touch on all elements of our humanity.
Well, give me an example of some of them. Which ones really stand out for you?
Sure. This is one I like a lot. I received this about 6 months ago on a 4x6 note card, and it reads, "I would give anything for an opportunity to show even the smallest kindness to my ex-wife." Another one came to me on a picture of a wedding, and across the front reads, "I'm terrified I will never get married." And then another one that's kind of funny I received about 5.5 months ago, and it reads, "I once wrote an X-rated letter to a boyfriend who broke up with me before I could give it to him. I gave it to my next boyfriend."
Well, the thing that I really love about all these secrets is they're absolutely honest. I mean, they come from a place of just, you know, pure honesty.
I think that's right. I think there's something therapeutic about organizing your secret into words and putting it on a postcard and then facing that card and then physically releasing it into a mailbox. And with some of the secrets, you can almost tell it's almost like a work in process. Part of it, I think, is the person trying to understand better their own secrets so they can maybe take action on them or change their behavior. There's one I like quite a bit, and it's a secret that's kind of confusing, but I think there's beauty in that. Can I read it to you?
Sure.
It arrived on the back of a photograph of a bedroom mirror with a few items tucked into the corner of the mirror. And on the back, the person had written, "I steal small things from my friends to keep memories of how much I love them." And sometimes when I read that, I think it's funny. Sometimes I think it's tragic, but it always seems to be from somebody who's struggling to figure out what their secret is, and it always sounds like poetry to me.
Yeah, I like that one too. And, you know, there are those few in the book that really stand out. There's one in Braille.
Yes.
Which is really interesting. And were there any that really surprised you? At maybe the level of honesty, maybe the level of artwork, maybe there was just what they said just was so shocking.
Well, what I find interesting about the secrets is the stories behind them. Each one almost seems like the first line of a novel. Some come from older people, some come from younger people. All types of people are represented. Here's one I received from a high school student who wrote, "I paid an F student $50 to write my valedictorian speech, and it was way better than mine could ever have been." It's almost like a little peek into mm-hmm. these people's lives. Sometimes I feel like I'm invisible and I'm getting this privileged view into this hidden landscape that we all share but nobody talks about.
Is that what appeals to you about this idea of secrets and confession? I mean, what motivates you to sort of, or motivated you to start this project?
Yeah, it's difficult for me to really understand why I'm doing this because I'm just a typical father, husband, and small business owner. I have no artistic training or background. I sometimes think that this project found me rather than me discovering it. But if I had to give you a reason, I think it would be that I had my own secret that I was carrying for over 30 years. I'd never shared with anyone. And once I started this project and people's secrets started coming to me and I saw the courage that they were showing and sharing their secret with me, I was able to face a secret that I had been carrying, share it with my wife and my daughter, and I put it on a postcard and mailed it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a sense, maybe this project is just a very elaborate therapy for me.
Well, see, that was going to be one of my questions, is if you mailed one to yourself, because it seems like a natural response to a project like this to include yourself in a way.
Yeah, I hadn't really planned on it at the beginning, but like so many people, when you look at the book or you look at the website and you see other people's soulful, thoughtful secrets, it reminds you of things you're carrying in your own life that you might not even think of as a secret, and it helps you to face them yourself.
Now, this book has moved on to an exhibit and a website, right?
Yes, currently we're showing over 1,000 of the actual postcards I've received in a gallery in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. In fact, the Washington Post just wrote a review of the exhibition and ranked it as one of the top 5 exhibitions in Washington, D.C. in 2005, so we're happy about that.
And PostSecret.com is doing very well.
PostSecret.com is the blog that we use to show 20 to 30 new postcards every Sunday. We post new secrets on the web, and then we also have the book that's doing very well also.
And with this blog, I saw that people were sending in emails and responding to the book and to the exhibit and to the website.
Mm-hmm.
Have there been any responses that have really stood out for you?
I do receive quite a bit of email from people following up after they've mailed in a postcard or talking about their experience. I have one right here. Can I read it to you?
Sure.
This one I received about 6.5 months ago, and it reads, "Dear Frank, I've made 6 postcards, all with secrets that I was afraid to tell the one person I tell everything to, my boyfriend. This morning I planned to mail them, but instead I left them on the pillow next to his head while he was sleeping. 10 minutes ago, he arrived at my office and asked me to marry him. I said yes." So you can see the power that these secrets hold and how they can affect our lives and how we can address them or face them and take ownership over them.
Yeah, that's a beautiful email, too.
I was happy to receive that.
Yeah. So is there going to be a second book? Is there going to be a follow-up?
I try not to have any intention with the project. I just kind of lead where it goes, and so I don't know what's going to happen next. I'm just enjoying the journey.
Well, if people want to explore the journey with you and learn about more of the secrets that people have sent you, there's the book out now, right?
Yeah, Post Secret. It's one word, Extraordinary Confessions from Ordinary Lives, and it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all over.
And postsecret.com, where it's being continuously updated with new secrets.
That's exactly right.
Well, Frank, thanks for joining us, and thanks for telling us about secrets.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to Sidetrack. This is Sidetrack. Computer hacking brings to mind the thief who tries to take over your system, stealing valuable information or rendering your machine useless. But hackers also help improve computing's best defenses, the security systems that prevent ill-intentioned attacks. Recently, a University of Illinois club known as SIGMIL placed fourth in a worldwide hacking competition. The goal was to enter other teams' systems while keeping them from attacking yours. Tom Rogers spoke with Frank Stratton, an undergraduate member of the U of I team.
Getting into the nuts and bolts of computers and how they work, exploring, you know, computer systems and computer programs, it's very exciting, at least to me.
Did you do any hacking at all before coming to the school or anything like that?
Nothing as formal as that, but...
Informal?
Informal.
It's got a bad reputation, obviously.
It does. I don't know, it's... You read about, you know, some event... In the newspaper or on the internet somewhere, and you know it gets a bad reputation. But the stuff we do is a lot of fun. It's promoting writing secure software and just being prepared for you know when the evil hackers attack.
So I guess you could call it hacking for good.
Huh? Yes.
What kinds of things do you do during the contest?
It's a very short contest. For something like this, it's about 6 hours long, and so it's very fast paced. And for us, we had several different like subgroups, people who would look at attacks from other teams coming at us, looking at you know web server logs and things like that to figure out how to defend our system. And then we had a couple of groups who would just look through source code, play around with the stuff that was running on our machine. Just poking at it to see what breaks and what doesn't.
So it's two-way. While you're trying to hack into other people's systems, they're trying to get into yours, and you've got to defend yourself.
Absolutely. So it's not all about the attacking. It's actually, I think most of the points come from defense and being able to keep your services uncompromised.
How tough is the competition?
Oh, it's very tough. It's grown so much in the past 3 years. There are over 22 teams now. And it's quite a fight to stay at the top of the leaderboard.
How is this like protecting real-life servers and systems?
Well, the way the contest is designed is that you're running some sort of potentially real-life system, like a web server, You could be running a shopping site or a guest book, or you could be running a mail server, things that are common. And the vulnerabilities that are built into these systems that we practice on are common exploits that you might find in the real world. For many of the other teams, it's a semester-long class to prepare for the Capture the Flag. But for us, Capture the Flag is just really a small note throughout the year. Like I said, we give talks every week. We prepare people, you know, through just general security awareness. So each week, a member of our group will, you know, pick a topic that he enjoys and give a talk on it.
Do you get help from people who may have done some other kinds of hacking for bad before?
Not necessarily. Let's see how to word this.
I don't want to implicate anyone.
No, I plead the fifth. Yeah. No, other than just what's been published out there on the internet, topics from websites, papers, research papers, and just, you know, other hacker papers that people have written, we take those and we look at them and analyze them and discuss them at our meetings. I find that for people on the outside who don't really know much about it, it's very much a kind of like a magical thing that happens sometimes with computer software. Being a part of the industry and, you know, actually seeing how things work and what makes, you know, a piece of software secure and what makes it vulnerable is it's very exciting to me. It's very eye-opening.
Frank Stratton is a University of Illinois junior who took part in the International Capture the Flag competition, an online test for hackers and computer security systems alike. He spoke with Tom Rogers. This is Sidetrack. First lines are important, not just for those cruising nightclubs in search of that special someone, but for authors. The American Book Review has just come out with its list of the 100 best first lines from novels. Jim Brown reports.
Charles Harris, a retired professor from Illinois State University, is the publisher of the American Book Review. He says defining what makes a great first line is a bit tough, because while some meander for hundreds of words, others are just three words. But Harris says there is one thing that all of the 100 best first lines have in common.
They're all memorable, but they're memorable for different reasons. Some have a kind of a say-what quality. You read it and it immediately grabs you. Dodie Smith's I Capture the Castle begins, "I write this sitting in the kitchen sink." Ian Banks's The Crow Road begins, "It was the day my grandmother exploded." you see what I mean? A more familiar one.
That's an attention grabber.
Well, yes. And a more familiar one is Orwell's 1984, which begins, "It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Others work for different reasons. The first line, the one that our jurors selected as the most memorable line of all time, at least for this year, is the opening line from Herman Melville's classic novel, Moby Dick. It ties for the shortest line on the list. It's, "Call me Ishmael." Why do we remember that one? Certainly it doesn't have the same attention-grabbing impact that the ones I read earlier had.
But it has become a part of our culture.
It's become a part of our culture. It's highly imitated. I can think of at least two other novels, well-known novels, that imitate it. Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle begins, "Call me Jonah." Philip Roth's The Great American Novel begins, "Call me Smitty." And neither of those is on the list, but they're memorable because they echo that opening line of Moby Dick.
Is there a correlation between an excellent first line and a great book?
No. Interestingly enough, this came as a surprise to us, but it shouldn't have. A lot of great books don't have particularly memorable opening lines. And a lot of very good opening lines start books that are not all that significant.
Did any of these lines surprise you by their inclusion in the list?
Yes, they did. As I say, there are familiar chestnuts here. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times from Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. Leo Tolstoy begins Anna Karenina with the famous line, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." Even Snoopy's favorite, "It was a dark and stormy night," which begins an opening sentence famous for its ungainliness, its badness, makes the list. But among these familiar chestnuts, there are lines that some I'd not heard of before. Others start novels that are not particularly well known, and yet I can't quarrel with their presence on the list. Here's one that's a kind of a favorite of mine, but I'm surprised it made the list. It's from a detective novel called The Last Good Kiss by James Crumley. "When I finally caught up with Abraham Traherne, he was drinking beer with an alcoholic bulldog named Fireball Roberts in a ramshackle joint just outside of Sonoma, California, drinking the heart right out of a fine spring afternoon." Wonderful first sentence, but a kind of a surprise.
I imagine you puffing on a Chesterfield with a glass of cheap whiskey on the desk next to you as you read that one.
Well, it's a wonderful line. And as I say, I don't think anyone would have predicted its presence on the list. There are surprises in the sense that there are famous writers represented here, but the novels aren't necessarily famous. Orlando by Virginia Woolf is here. To the Lighthouse, a better-known novel by her, is not. Intruder in the Dust by Faulkner makes the list. Absalom, Absalom, one of his great novels, does not.
Which one do you wish you'd written?
Oh, my. There's so many. John Barth is a particular favorite of mine. I love the opening to The End of the Road. In a sense, I am Jacob Horner. Then he writes an opening line, too long to read here, that goes on for over 100 words, introducing the Sotweed factor.
Why compile this list?
That's a good question. I'm a sucker for lists, number one. It's my magazine, so I can do what I want to do. But I can tell you how I got the idea. The American Film Institute recently released their list of the 100 best movie lines. Well, I'm also a movie fan. I love that list. So I said, well, I wonder if we could come up with a list of 100 famous opening lines. I doubted it.
How important is the first line compared to, say, the first 20 pages when it comes to drawing the reader in?
It really depends. There are novels whose first lines immediately capture our attention. There are other novels that start a little more leisurely. Novels entice us in different ways.
Let's close with a first sentence.
Here is one that that anybody who's read this novel is going to say, oh, yes, just a few words into the novel. "If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you'll probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it if you want to know the truth." That's Holden Caulfield from J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye.
Charles Harris says the 100 best lines were culled from a list of 300 submissions. You can see if your favorite author or book made the list by picking up the current edition of American Book Review. I'm Jim Brown.
Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. And the show is podcast there as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.